everyone. My name is Aarti, and this is the Mahabharata. Episode 52, Krishna versus Battlestar Sorb, also available online at www.themahabharatapodcast.com or facebook.com/themahabharatapodcast. Our last episode concluded with a family council in the Karmyaka forest. The Pandavas' friends and relatives have gathered to express shock and consternation. Draupadi's brothers are there with the children, folks of the junior wives are there, and Krishna is there as well, with Subhadra and wee Abhimanyu. There are surely women about, but as usual, they're invisible. The only vocal presence is Draupadi, and when we left her, she was giving passionate vent to her feelings of betrayal by all the men in her life. "Where were you?" she demands of Krishna. "You're my friend. You deserted me in my most dire hour of need. Why didn't you protect me?" Her reproach lingered in the air long after we concluded the episode. Now, if you're a newcomer to the Mahabharata, uninvested in the tradition, this moment is nothing. Draupadi's angry and she's demanding from her loved ones why they failed her. But if you're an insider to the tradition, raised in Krishna devotion, the moment has import. Just ask your dadima, where was Krishna? Who do you think was behind the miracle? She'll look at you over her spectacles, a twinkle in her eye. Your pandit, purohit, legions of televangelists, not to mention uncles, aunties and little cousin Bunty will all confirm. Krishna's the unseen hand at work behind the endless roll of fabric that protected Draupadi from being stripped utterly naked. The scene is celebrated in liturgy, drama, dance, every art form. Draupadi cries out to Krishna, and in the top corner of our television screen, a miniature Krishna appears with a continuous stream of textile issuing from his raised palm. Sometimes the fabric changes colour, roughly corresponding to the length of a sari. Poor fiendish Dushasana heaves and pulls, but cannot disrobe her. Sweat pours off his brow, his muscles start to quiver until he collapses. It's a very satisfying scene and triumphant tale for Krishna Bhakti. Problem is, we're reading the text, and in our text, A, Krishna's not there, and B, he seems to have no clue about Draupadi's predicament, until informed later. Now, if you're an ardent fan of the scene, you'll protest that there are multiple recensions of the Mahabharata and some manuscripts contain such a scene. But if you're an historian, you look for corroborating evidence elsewhere and note that there's no such scene even in the Harivansha. That's a work that minutely absorbs itself with all things Krishna and multiple times provides enthusiastic resumes of all Krishna's acts and deeds. But scan it any which way, Krishna performs many miracles, but saving Draupadi isn't one of them. So how should we think about this? In my humble opinion, our text intends the miracle to be connected to Draupadi's virtue. Like Sita in the Ramayana, who saves herself from Ravan's assault with a single blade of grass photon charged with the power of her virtue, Draupadi's virtue saves her. We already know virtue has such power. It generates tapas, which allows you to vaporize opponents and transform slothful roommates into actual sloths. So what's an impromptu textile operation? Soon we'll see a woman's virtue can literally bring a man back from the dead. Draupadi is a thermonuclear storehouse of tapas. It's specifically in recognizing her nuclear capability that Dhritarashtra backs off the gambling. Looking at her now, devastated and distraught, Krishna comforts her. Weep shall the women of those who've hurt you when their men lie in pieces, shod in a monsoon torrent of blood. I promise you, Draupadi, the sky will fall, mountains will crumble, the earth itself will splinter into bits. But my word shall not be false. Do not sorrow. He explains his absence. I swear, had I been in Dwarka earlier, this would not have happened. I would have stopped it. I would have condemned the gambling. If that failed, I would have worked the audience, those cowardly enemies pretending to be friends. Failing that, I would have shut it down by force. But I was away, and I heard of it only upon my return from cousin Yuyudhan. He tells a story. Remember Krishna had been the guest of honor at Yudhishthira's Rajasuya sacrifice? And remember one attendee at that august occasion had been their mutual cousin Shishupal, born with three eyes and four arms? And remember said cousin had blathered on recklessly, insulting Bhishma and reviling Krishna with fighting words for his masterminding the bifurcation of Jarasandh? And remember he'd promptly gotten his head lobbed off? Well, apparently folks back home didn't like that. So while Krishna remained at Indraprastha, enjoying the Rajasuya after party, Shishupal's pal Shalva launches a surprise attack on Krishna's city, Dwarka. No, not Amba's failed lover Shalva. This is another chap of no great consequence to us except for two things. One, he lays siege to Dwarka while Krishna's away. And two, he keeps Krishna's attention diverted while the gambling fiasco's on. And oh, he has a really cool car. Let's give Shalva his 15 minutes of fame. He's king of a city named Sob, whose notable quality is, are you ready for this, everyone? Airborne vehicles straight out of Star Wars. Yes, you heard that right. Spacecraft in the Mahabharata. But what of it? We've got flying horses and cows who urinate armies. Are starships where we draw the line? So yes, Shalva rides a super cool aerial vehicle. Is it a plane? Is it a Black Hawk? Is it a starship? Our text doesn't tell us. Nor do we learn if it's the product of tinkering in the garage on the weekend or for thriving aeronautics industry. But one thing's for certain, a B-52 bomber provides a definite tactical advantage. While Krishna's chilling with the Pandavas, Shalva takes the opportunity to attack Krishna's city, Dwarka. Now, a few words about Krishna. Contrary to what one might suppose, the Mahabharata tells us very little about Krishna. We witness nothing of his fabled childhood, his personal life, or his youth. When we see him, it's almost always in the context of the Pandavas. This episode is one of the rare occasions where we get a peek into Krishna's world and its challenges. We see his city, Dwarka, on the coast of modern Gujarat. We meet his sons, and he has a few. We see his clan, the Vrishnis, who are a feisty, scrappy, fractious lot, hot-blooded and super competitive. And we see Krishna himself, beleaguered by an enemy, his city trashed, and he put upon by magic tricks that play upon his emotions. A rare moment, believe me. The city of Dwarka is the new home of Krishna's rowdy, rambunctious clan, the Vrishnis. They moved there largely offstage to escape the repeated attacks of Jarasandh, who'd prior bad blood with Krishna. Refer to episode 39 if you need a refresher. The Vrishnis see a lot of war, so the city of Dwarka's built to withstand enemies. I'm thinking mighty fortress, formidable like Constantinople, naturally defensively located, bolstered with multi-tiered walls, 3 meters thick, 12 meters high, gate towers, watchtowers, turrets, ramparts. Let's throw in a water system modeled on Masada, machicolations and murder holes, battlements equipped with every manner of weapon, and moats filled with hungry crocodiles. It's vast. Within its walls dwell the city folk. There's armed border patrol, and it's equipped for a siege of many years. In the wee hours of the morning, Shalva's troops encircle the city, setting the sirens a shriek. The Vrishni men swing into action. Emergency meeting at the Pentagon establishes first order of business, banned booze. Everyone knows what happens when you mix a Vrishni with vodka. To underscore the point, bars and theatres are shuttered. The Vrishnis are skilled martial artists, Krishna's sons among the best. They fan out, moving with overwhelming speed and force. The younger Sambha leads the left flank, the elder Pradyumna the right. Moving nimbly, in deft and daring moves, Sam slices through the troops, 1 minute sword, next minute arrow. With his favorite weapon, the club, he takes out Shalva's general, dealing him a crushing blow to the head. The man topples off his horse to fall, head bashed open. On the other side is the blur of Pim's emblem, its flame-coloured crocodile mouth ajar. He shoots with lightning speed. He's ambidextrous. Taking his sword, he hacks through the ranks like he's dropping weeds, splaying entrails left and right. But Shalva evades him, shooting into the sky. No matter, Pim deploys surface-to-air missiles, shooting with rapidity, one and another, showering Shalva with such a hailstorm of missiles, the ship's defences are breached and Shalva takes one to the heart. But he staggers back to knock Pim a stunning blow to the head. Krishna's son drops, unconscious. His driver swiftly whisks him away. While the battle continues, Pim's driver works feverishly to resuscitate him. As he recovers, Pim sits up. "What are you thinking?" he yells. "Have you lost your mind?" He staggers to his feet. "We're the Vrishnis. We don't run from battle. I'd rather die than run. Take me back, and don't you ever do that again." His driver's unfazed. "You can't fight if you're dead. It's my job to protect you." They re-enter the fray. "What'll my brothers say? My uncles, my dad? I'll be the laughing stock." He throws himself into the battle with ferocity. Soon he's back face to face with Shalva, who unleashes a string of magic tricks. But Pim's laser focused. "You will not escape me." He blasts Shalva so relentlessly, he's about to finish him when the heavenly PA system booms out. "Stop, Pradyumna. This is not your kill. This one belongs to your dad, okay? Put your weapons away." Bow raised, poised, Pim's torn for a moment. Shalva's shuttle swooshes his wounded body away. "When I arrived home," Krishna continues, "I saw my city a mess. The gardens were trashed. The women looked shell-shocked. Children were running about like vagrants. No school, no rituals. What's the matter?" I asked my cousins in alarm. When they told me, I was so mad, I decided to kill Shalva. I calmed the city, told everyone to return to work. "I will not enter Dwarka again until I've butchered that miscreant. I'm going to turn his city to dust." Taking a small force, Krishna pursues Shalva. Riding swiftly, he passes forests and rivers, mountains and lakes, and finds him ensorbed by the seaside. As soon as he spies Krishna, Shalva jumps into his shuttle and starts blasting, wounding Krishna's soldiers, his driver, his horses. Krishna's grim with rage. He deploys divine weapons, but Shalva evades, taking to the skies. Krishna targets Shalva's crew. One by one, severed arms and shoulders, heads and trunks start raining down from the skies, accompanied by ghastly screams. Then Shalva tries wizardry. One moment it's day, next it's night, one moment sweltering, next moment snow. He cuts Krishna's driver with so many arrows, there's not a hair to be seen on the man. He's a fountain of blood. Then a messenger comes racing to Krishna. "Your dad's dead," he tells him with a gasp. "While you were searching for him, Shalva killed your dad. You must return immediately. Dwarka's in catastrophe." Says Krishna, "When I heard the message, I was crushed. I couldn't think what to do, where my duty lay. In my heart, I cursed my brother, my cousins, my sons. Couldn't all of them together keep my father safe? I'd entrusted the city to them to pursue this criminal. Then a worse thought occurred to me. What if they were all dead? Because how could my father possibly be killed if even one of those heroes were alive? Clearly, they were all dead if my father's dead." My bow dropped from my hand. My mind was a whirl. I couldn't think. I couldn't see. I sank in confusion upon my chariot. Then I realized it's an illusion. My father's fine, my family's fine. I picked up my bow. He deployed cloaking technology, I penetrated it. He ducked, I followed. His evil crew screeched and howled, filling the skies with deafening sound. I deployed noise-canceling technology. Then my driver lost it. "Will you please stop goofing around? There he is, right in front of you. No more Mr. Nice Guy. Kill him already." I took my favorite weapon, my diamond blade hacksaw disc that cuts through mountains. It set fire to the city. Then I hurled it at Shalva. A moment later, there was his head, clean guillotine slice, dropped at my feet. There's spellbound silence as the Pandavas hear the story. Even the birds and creatures have gone quiet. "This is why," Krishna explains to the group, "I wasn't at Hastinapur. This villainous wretch consumed my attention at that critical moment when you were struck by calamity. As soon as I learned of it, I rushed here." In our next episode, the visitors will depart. The Pandavas will be left with the brute reality of 13 years stretched before them till they see home again. What will they say? What will they do? Let's find out next time if you'll join me for another episode of the Mahabharata.